right, my first question is,
who do they think they are, releasing us to look after people?
This podcast is about nurses on nursing, and this is a fantastic example.
My name is Bronwyn Tarrant.
You've got a nice deep voice there, Bronwyn. It's just right for a podcast.
It's the whole world of nursing.
You're listening to Adventures in Research. I'm Bronwyn Tarrant.
And I'm Amelia Swift.
So, Amelia, what's really exciting about this is I've come across two younger nurses, or young in terms of research, looking at problems in nursing. They've come up with questions that they've noticed clinically and tried to drill down into it. So they've looked at the research and or publications, and it hasn't given them a great answer to what they're looking for.
Why is that? Is it that there isn't much published research on the subject?
Yeah, or it's a bit outdated, or it comes from a different perspective. So, for example, we'll be listening in a moment to Hosu Rayon, who is a mental health nurse, and she's also an academic at one of the universities here in Australia. But the most important thing is she's worked for a really long time in a very specific area of mental health, which is very challenging, notoriously so, which is working with young people with eating disorders. And what happens, and it's quite well known, that what happens is that for some reason nurses find it really difficult to work in that environment. And not often do nurses who go there as part of a grad year end up going back there to work in those units. And she wanted to understand a bit more about what that's like. And so she spoke with young nurses. She was asking them, and when I say young nurses, I should say new nurses, about their experience of working in eating disorder units. It's such a drill down into that. And she found that as she was having these conversations, that it took her back to learning about psychodynamic understanding of transference and countertransference. And maybe I should talk a tiny bit about transference and countertransference. Do you remember much about transference and countertransference in the world?
No, because I'm an adult nurse, and so I don't have to deal with any psychological theory at all. That's not true, but definitely would appreciate an explanation. Thank you.
Okay, so transference. Now, some people, particularly Americans, get it wrong and say transference. Not that I have a problem with people from the North American states, but it has its origins in the Jungian and Freudian tradition, which is transference. And transference is where you transfer your emotional or unconscious material onto someone else. In a therapeutic relationship, you're talking about really intimate stuff. In mental health, we get to hear all kinds of things. Oftentimes it surprises people what we get to hear, and people just like to tell us. But sometimes you hear something that's quite distressing. And the idea is that sometimes when people talk, emotion goes with it, and that's transferred onto you. And you try and understand what that's about and make sense of it, and then reflect that back to a consumer or a person. So somebody might say, for example, in a really angry way, "I don't want to eat dinner." And you'll say, "Oh, I thought you sounded a bit angry. Are you feeling a bit angry about dinner?" And they'll say no, but you've obviously had that feeling of that. So that's understanding transference. Countertransference is often always where you project onto them. You put your feelings onto the person. And that's really important in mental health nursing, is to be really aware of ourselves as nurses, what we're doing that affects the person, and to keep our own shit in order, really. Sort your stuff out. And so Hosu was really interested, because what seemed to be happening was something around countertransference with these new nurses and these patients with eating disorders. Let me roll the tape. That was the segue while I was trying to find the tape.
Just while you're finding that tape, it just reminds me of, or it makes me think about, what it's like to work with a group of patients that might be labelled as difficult. And I've done a lot of work in chronic pain, and in the olden days, they used to call certain patients heart sink patients. And these heart sink patients would have, in the days of physical hospital notes, they'd have a stack of hospital notes 6 foot high, because they'd had so many appointments and so many therapies, and it had all failed. And so they became very difficult to engage with because they'd lost their trust in the system and nobody was helping them. And so they would arrive in a clinic with some residual hope, but also some anger and some anxiety. And the clinician who'd seen this big stack of notes would already know that everybody else that they'd seen had failed them somehow. And so they'd start off the consultation with a sense of hopelessness and defeat. And so you've got a defeated patient meeting a defeated clinician. And one of the things I certainly experienced as working in that environment was a sense of an increasing sense of worthlessness and inability to help people. And that's directly counter to what you join the nursing profession for, because you join the nursing profession to help people. And if you can't cure somebody, or at least ameliorate their symptoms and make them feel a bit better, or make them more accepting of their situation, then what is your purpose as a nurse? So when I think about transference and counter-transference, as you're talking about it, I also think of the contribution that taking on somebody else's emotional load, it has a massive contribution to a sense of burnout and a loss of satisfaction in your job and role confusion and all of those kind of things.
Okay, so on my messy desktop, I've got Hosu there, just spelled incorrectly. So Hosu has been able to publish her work in the International Journal of Mental Health Nursing, which is one of the leading international journals. And because it's so interesting. So we'll provide that link on the website. Let's have a listen.
Fantastic. Just before you do, let us listen to Hosu. I just have to say, how Australian are you today with your upward inflection?
Oh, did I have it then?
Everything's going up at the end.
It pisses me off so much when people do that.
You don't normally do it. It's really funny.
I know. Okay. I'll stop that now.
We understand the emotional experience of early career.
Okay, let's start there.
Can you tell us a bit about your research then? What was your research question?
So my research question, my topic of research was on the emotional experience of early career mental health nurses in Victoria, in Australia. So the question was, how can we understand the emotional experience of early career mental health nurses who's working in an eating disorders unit. Sorry, I didn't say eating disorders unit before. That's the most important part there. So I was exploring the experience of nurses who work in the eating disorders unit. It's a qualitative descriptive study. We explore the emotional experience of nurses through the psychodynamic lens that is cancer transference.
So Bron, can I just it there? I think this is probably a nice time to say, what is qualitative descriptive work? So I know that qualitative research is about collecting a narrative. It's about collecting stories from people and trying to understand their experiences in their own words. And there are different types of qualitative research. So the big three that people talk about a lot, which we can explain in other podcasts as we get to them, is phenomenology, grounded theory, and ethnography. And when somebody says qualitative descriptive to me, it feels like they haven't really got one of those traditions behind their work, that they're going much more for a free, loose approach. I'm just going to collect these stories and see what comes out at the end. Now, Hosu might explain that a bit more in her discussion with us. Do you think that's what she was aiming at to start with, or was this just a broad term that she uses?
So Hosu knew that she was picking up on some counter-transferency stuff. That's what got her interested to begin with, remember. And to then think about where she was coming from, I think that what she wanted to do is to be as pure and naive in that approach as she could be, so she didn't taint anything with this her own counter transference and so forth, or reenact something, a parallel process. But she'll talk about it further, I think.
Coming at it from a naive experience point of view strikes me as a more ethnographic approach, where and this is where Hosu seems to be coming from. She's experienced living in the world of this eating disorders unit. She knows what it's like, and she's observing something about working in that environment which is resonating with her emotionally. And so that's made her think about how she can use that experience and find out about the experience of other people. So this does, while she says it's qualitative descriptive, I'm wondering whether she's really coming at this from an ethnographic perspective. But that's me. I'll stop now. Let's listen to a bit more.
Fantastic.
So interesting. So what is it about mental health nurses in eating disorder units that makes this so important?
I think it is mental health nurses, we use ourselves as therapeutic tool, and trying to engage with others and understand others. It is really important to understand what's going on within us to start with, to be able to provide, to be able to help other people authentically through their recovery. So I thought that of course, it's important for other nurses too, but for mental health nurses, given that we use ourselves as a therapeutic tool, it is really important that we understand what's going on within us when we are engaging with our consumers.
So is that where countertransference comes in? Can you unpack what countertransference is for us?
Sure. So countertransference is there are different definitions, but how we look at it is it's a conscious or unconscious thoughts and emotions experienced by clinicians, in this case nurses, evoked from the engagement with consumers. So a lot of mental health nursing work is very relational work, so there are times when thoughts and emotions and unconsciously they're evoked by those engagement. And that's why I thought the concept of conscious transference is something that is quite crucial in mental health working.
So counter transference is a psychodynamic understanding, as you were saying, about how people respond to, how mental health nurses respond to engaging with people. How did you investigate that? How did you find out what was going on?
So what we did was we did a semi-structured interviews to the nurses that who are working in the eating disorders unit, and we didn't obviously ask about countertransference, but the countertransference actually used more as a the psychodynamic concept that we applied in the data analysis part. What we really explored was the experience of the nurses, and then in the process of data analysis, that's when the this lens of countertransference came in, and then we tried to look at it through the lens of that to be able to understand nurses' experience. And we looked at it as one of the way to explain the nurses' experience.
So, Bron, if you can pause there, the interesting thing there is she's now talking about a framework, a theoretical framework. When she talks about this lens that she's looking at the experience of the nurses through, that lens is providing her with a theoretical framework to explore the topic area.
So can you explain that to me about, so we start with thinking about qualitative descriptive. And you're saying that there's ethnographic and phenomenological, and I say grounded theory. What did you say?
Well, we said phenomenology, ethnography, and grounded theory.
Yeah,
and ethnography is defined as studying people in their own environment, using observation and interview. And quite often, an ethnographer will be in the culture that they're studying. So it's almost like an anthropological study. And I really find them absolutely fascinating because, of course, the person who's living in that culture, the person who's part of that culture, has their own experiences to bring to the question. And so they're very often very insightful about what questions to ask and who to target in the interviews. And they can really dig in to some of the deep issues because of their experience within the culture. In one of our other podcasts, we're going to be talking to Cara Bailey, who is, she started off her research, her PhD research, started looking at the trajectories of dying in the emergency department. And she was looking at people who were brought into the emergency department in the terminal phase of their life. And some of those people should have been having palliative care at home, and they should be dying at home. But because the people who were caring for them, often their families, were unsupported at home and very frightened, they would end up bringing their relative to the emergency department, and the relative would die in the emergency department. And it wasn't what we would call a good death. It wasn't how the death was intended to be. And it was for a lack of support at home and a lack of confidence in the carers. Whereas the other people she was comparing that experience to were people who were having a traumatic death. So they had arrived in the emergency department, perhaps by an ambulance following a road traffic collision or something, and there was a big event, and it was very much in keeping with the work of the emergency department. That's what they're there for, to deal with these very big and what some people might call sexy, you know, crash, huge, big banging events. And so she looked at the nurses in each of the who were having each of these experiences. And what she found was the patients that were unexpectedly there, the palliative end of life care patients who weren't supposed to be there, weren't receiving the same level of attention that the traumatic people, the people who were dying through a traumatic event, were receiving. And it was because of the mindset of the nurses in that department, and because what the way the department was set up, what it was designed to do. So you, as a nurse, you're designed to work in this particular way with this group of patients, and off you go. So she called this the trajectories of dying, and we'll get her to talk about that. But the point I'm trying to make, sorry, very lengthy, the point I'm trying to make is that Cara knew that this was happening because she was very interested in end-of-life care and palliative care, but she was a nurse in that emergency department. And so working in the department, she noticed that there was something going wrong, and being interested in palliative care and noticing other people weren't so interested in it, she could see that there was a real difference. And so being there, so that's ethnography, being buried in that culture enables you to have a particular perspective about what's going on in that culture.
And it'll be wonderful to have these back to back and to listen to those bits that you've just spoken about.
And I think a lot of our examples will help us to do this, because of course we are going to be talking about research that interests us and research that has power to change what we do. And the whole point of this podcast series, isn't it, to inspire people who are providing the care to ask the questions that will make the changes that they know need to happen. So bring it on. Let's hear some more from Hosu.
Okay, let's keep going.
I mean, this is such an interesting study. So partly you didn't tell participants, the nurses who you were interviewing, you didn't say, I'm looking at counter transference in eating disorder units. You didn't tell them that. And yet you were able to use that lens to understand the data that they gave you. What kind of questions, you said semi-structured interviewing, I think. What kind of questions did you ask?
Do you want to talk about what a semi-structured interview is?
Yeah. So do you want to do a bit of theory exposition there, Bron?
I could, but for me, a structured interview is very clearly where you know what questions you're going to ask. They've been really well designed, and you stick to that recipe and you ask those questions in the same way. Whereas a semi-structured interview has questions that you think will be able to drill down into things, and yet is still responsive. So it guides conversation or eliciting information. but it's semi-structured because it's not so prescriptive and uniform. Now, I might have got that wrong, Amelia. Correct me.
No, I think that's exactly what it is. The comparison I think is that a structured interview is more like a questionnaire. There's no room for movement. And so if you haven't formulated your question correctly, it might be misinterpreted or it might not elicit the information you're really after. And a semi-structured interview where you have the questions pre-designed has to go through the ethics committee. So you say, these are the questions I'm going to ask, but they're triggers, and you have a series of follow-up options afterwards. And you just, so each question that you send through the ethics committee, you are going to ask that question, but then you've got a series of more loose prompts afterwards to help you explore the answer that the person is giving you. And it always makes it difficult. Well, I find it very difficult putting a semi-structured interview through an ethics committee. Because you're stuck to what you say you're going to do. And so you do have to have that sense check beforehand. And it's always a good idea to practice your interview questions quite a lot before you go off and do your research. Otherwise, you'll find that you're just not getting the answers that you thought you were. And then you'll have to go back through the ethics committee to change your questions. And of course, the ethics committee bit is really important because you do need that external scrutiny that the questions you're asking somebody are not too intrusive, or they might be unethical because they're eliciting information from a person that is highly sensitive or controversial. And so, and we get straight into the territory, perhaps not in this study, but in other studies, you might stray into the territory of actually actively encouraging people to say things that are suggest that they're unprofessional or uncaring or something that is socially unacceptable in their role. And so we do have to be very, very careful about the design of those questions.
Really good. So let's see what questions she ended up coming up with.
Brilliant.
To uncover that unconscious stuff that was going on.
The questions that I asked in the semi-structured interviews, I mean, it was all quite different to all the participants because it was quite, I guess, personal. But the questions that I started with were, how was your experience in eating disorders unit? And one of the questions I remember that brought lots of rich data was, have you felt something while working in the eating disorders unit that you don't really want to admit? I think it was a question.
So there you go.
Yes,
there's a question straight away about, you know, it's counter to your role, isn't it? What do you not want to admit? What a brilliant question. Really getting, and what she's talking about, she's trying to talk about people opening up about their feelings about working in this place, and that absolutely goes to the heart of why people might not want to stay. That's such a brilliant question. Sorry, Bron, carry on.
And it is a brilliant question, and it's also about the self of the researcher, because Hosu is such a gentle soul. It's excellent mental healthness because she just has this way about her that people do want to speak to her.
So the therapist, I mean, this podcast is about nurses on nursing, and this is a fantastic example of how a nurse therapist is also a good researcher, because, of course, you do need to have the rapport and the communication skills to help people open up to you. You can't just ask a question in a very mechanical or automated way and expect people to give you a rich and descriptive answer about something which is quite difficult maybe to open up about. So I love that idea of having therapeutic skills as a researcher. I think that's really important.
Your questions were so well phrased that they were open and opened up the opportunity for people to really confide in you in a way.
That raises the issue for me of how people come up with their question sets. And so we've talked about ethnography and or being part of the culture that you're exploring, and that will give you or having experience that you want to explore more. So that gives you a kind of trigger for the questions you want to ask. So Hosu might have recognized in herself things that she felt were difficult to admit because that's against her role, or she feels that she has a professional obligation to behave slightly differently to how she feels. If I was a researcher exploring an area I wasn't familiar with, I wasn't part of that culture, then how would I come up with the right questions? So I think...
I don't know if you could you?
Well, people do though, don't they? I think, you know, if I'm exploring... I've not worked in a hospital ward for ages, and we're doing some research with our student nurses at the moment. The master's students are doing interviews with nurses in the hospitals, and we've come up with questions based on a framework. So we're doing interviews about whether there are any barriers to those nurses taking part in ward rounds, and so we've based the questions on our understanding of nurses' work and workload and on the theory of what a ward round is supposed to achieve. So we've kind of gone to the theory side of it to start to develop those questions. But it does strike me as we might need to come back to this at another time when we explore somebody who's an outsider looking in and come back to this idea of how did they come up with their questions? Because Hosu is in a very different situation here.
That's fantastic, because I think when we listen to Philippa in a moment, she is on the outside.
Ah, brilliant.
So we might see what happens. That's a really important point.
When we were talking about the meal times in the eating disorders ward, my participants, Peter, obviously not a real name, Peter said that it was like an invisible psychological warfare between a client and a clinician. It was a very powerful answer. Also,
let's unpack that one before we go to the other one.
Sure.
An invisible psychological warfare.
Yes.
That's really powerful information to be given. How did you then understand that?
I think this was during the mealtime, and we talked about how mealtime is such an emotionally heightened experience for lots of people who experience eating disorders, and partly because it is a time that is usually associated with the family time or mother and child interaction, and even the family dynamics that are common in eating disorders. I think this is the time that the people with eating disorders were feeling very, they were quite anxious. And during this time, nurses were also anxious as well. And what nurses do in the eating disorders unit is that we provide something called meal support. And it usually entails a nurse sitting at the table with a group of consumers, ensuring that people have adequate nutritional intake, but also redirecting consumers away from disordered eating behaviors while giving also emotional support. So there are lots of different things going on. And you're sitting there, this is actually Peter's word as well. He says, "You are still smiling, conversing, but at the same time, I think there's different things going like in back of our heads. So you are there trying to emotionally support somebody, but at the same time, you're almost enforcing somebody to do something that people, they don't want to." So there was that kind of discomfort in nurses and conflict within the nurses, especially in the nursing value that I'm supposed to be nurturing and supporting the person, but I'm also at the same time making the person doing something that they don't want to.
So interesting, isn't it? And I suppose part of what you're saying about the countertransference is that because I think what you're saying just then was that because the consumers are so anxious around this time, and for them it's about